Thank you very much, David. I thought it'd be interesting today to talk about global monetary developments because there are some quite unusual things happening in this area at the moment. Over the past 8 months, many central banks have reduced interest rates to unusually low levels. Some have also undertaken unconventional measures to implement monetary policy, such as giving commitments about the future path of interest rates, greatly expanding their balance sheets, and shifting the composition of their assets from securities that are short-term and relatively risk-free to those that are longer-term and somewhat riskier. Given the unprecedented nature of these measures, many people are asking what they mean for the world economy, and in particular for inflation. Debate about these issues will no doubt continue for a long time yet, and I certainly don't pretend to have the answers. In my talk today, I will set out what the various central banks have been doing and offer a perspective on how these actions could be interpreted. Until recently, the majority of the world's central banks followed a fairly standard model when it came to implementing monetary policy. First, a monetary policy committee or board set a target for a short-term interest rate, taking into account the central bank's objectives. Second, central banks then undertook operations in financial markets to adjust the supply of funds in the market to a level consistent with the targeted short-term interest rate. And third, changes in short-term rates fed through to a wide range of other interest rates in the economy. An important channel through which this approach to monetary policy works is by influencing the demand for credit. The supply of credit is assumed to adjust to demand, which in a world of deregulated financial systems and stable, well-functioning markets is a reasonable assumption. When markets are disrupted, however, the normal transmission mechanism can break down at several points. First, the relationship between the amount of funds supplied through market operations and the overnight interest rate can become unstable. For example, if banks start to hoard liquidity, more funds need to be supplied to keep the overnight rate at the target. Second, even if the target rate is achieved, the flow through to other interest rates in the economy can become impaired. If, for example, risk aversion in markets increases, interest rates for term funds rise relative to the overnight rate, and premiums for credit risk also rise. The reductions in the overnight rate targeted by central banks therefore may not flow through to the same extent as usual to interest rates charged on loans. Third, if banks become capital constrained, their willingness and capacity to lend at any interest rate will be diminished. As you know, over the past year, many countries have found that the normal monetary transmission mechanism has become less effective. As I noted, many central banks have responded to this by reducing official interest rates to abnormally low levels, in some cases close to zero. Most of this has happened since September last year. Up until then, monetary policy settings around the globe had been following a relatively normal path, guided mainly by inflationary pressures. Global monetary policy entered a tightening phase around 2004, and the majority of the world's central banks continued to tighten policy into 2008. Of the 35 largest countries or monetary areas, 23 had higher interest rates in September 2008 than at the start of that year. 7 had unchanged rates, and 5 had lower rates. This is not surprising because global inflationary pressures were still rising in the middle of 2008. Commodity markets did not peak until July 2008, and indicators of pressure in the global economy, such as prices charged on shipping contracts, were at extreme levels. The unusual period of monetary policy began in September 2008, after the failure of Lehman Brothers dramatically escalated the financial crisis. This in turn led to a collapse of household and business confidence around the world. Official interest rates have since been cut very sharply across virtually all countries due to the highly synchronised nature of the current economic cycle. The average reduction in interest rates has been about 330 basis points in the developed economies and about 300 basis points in emerging markets. Among the developed economies, only four, Australia, New Zealand, Denmark and Norway, still have interest rates above 1%. Official interest rates have never been this low in the developed world in the 150-year period for which we have data. The reason why official interest rates have been reduced to such extreme levels is that frictions in markets had made interest rates on loans to households and businesses less responsive to cuts in official rates. In the case of the US, for example, even though the Fed had reduced official rates by 325 basis points by September 2008, the standard mortgage rate in the US had hardly changed. Bigger cuts in official rates were therefore needed in order to bring about a given fall in loan rates on interest rates on loans. In assessing the level of global interest rates, it is important to look not just at official rates, but at a broader spectrum of rates faced by borrowers. We don't have data on housing rates going back 150 years, but it is clear that they are not at the very low levels of official rates. In most countries, including Australia, they are around 1.5 to 2 percentage points below their decade averages. That is, they're low, but not at extreme levels. For corporate borrowers, interest rates are not unusually low. In fact, in most developed economies, interest rates faced by corporations in capital markets are, if anything, still a little bit above decade averages due to the large increase in risk premiums. Let me now turn to the other unconventional measures that central banks have undertaken. These are often grouped in the popular press under the generic title of quantitative easing or printing money, but they really fall into three distinct categories. Measures to add to banks' reserve balances, measures to reduce the term structure of interest rates, and measures to support specific credit markets and or take credit risk onto central bank balance sheets. The United States Fed has coined the term credit easing to cover such policies. All these measures involve changes to either the composition or the size of central bank balance sheets. While all are aimed at sustaining the flow of credit in the economy, some do so by working on credit demand, while others aim to stimulate the supply of credit. The measures are not mutually exclusive, but can be mixed in different combinations to best suit the circumstances of the country. Indeed, it would make sense, in terms of maximising their impact, for policies to combine elements of each of these measures. Measures designed to increase the supply of bank reserves can, I think, be accurately described as quantitative easing. They involve the central bank increasing the size of its balance sheet by increasing purchases of securities from the market and crediting the process, the payments to banks' reserve balances at the central bank. These measures differ from routine market operations both in their scale and their intent. They involve operations on a much larger scale than normal. Some central banks have expanded the supply of reserves by several percentage points of GDP. Perhaps more importantly, the objectives underpinning quantitative easing are different. Whereas routine operations are working through interest rates to influence the demand for credit, quantitative easing seeks to influence the supply of credit. The aim is to provide more reserves than banks wish to hold, with the intention that they will dispose of those excess reserves by increasing their lending. This type of activity is usually undertaken only when interest rates have fallen to zero or near zero levels. While theoretically a central bank could undertake quantitative easing at any level of interest rates, in practice it is difficult to do so as large-scale provision of excess reserves forces the interest rate to zero. The central bank could stop this from happening by paying a market-based interest rate on reserve holdings, but this would undermine the purpose of the exercise by reducing the incentive for banks to lend their reserves. As I noted earlier, monetary policy settings in most countries are normally defined in terms of a target for the short-term interest rate. The precise relationship between official interest rates and the interest rates faced by borrowers varies from country to country. In some countries, such as Australia, where the bulk of banks' loans to customers are at floating rates, the relationship is usually relatively close. In countries where banks mainly lend to customers at long-term fixed rates, the relationship between official rates and loan rates is more complex and therefore more prone to being unsettled when market conditions deteriorate. As such, loan rates in these countries can become quite insensitive to changes in the short-term rate, reducing the effectiveness of monetary policy. Because of the limited flow-through from short rates to long rates, a number of central banks have recently undertaken direct measures to reduce longer-term interest rates. One way they have done this is by giving commitments to keep short-term rates low for a long time. Central banks in the United States, the UK, Canada, New Zealand and Sweden have all done this. By signalling such a commitment, forward interest rate expectations are lowered, resulting in lower long-term interest rates. The success of this measure in lowering term rates will naturally depend on how credible the commitments are that the banks have given. A second set of measures involves the central bank buying a large amount of long-term assets. Such measures work mainly through a portfolio balance effect, increasing the demand for these securities above what it would otherwise have been, thereby lowering their yields. There are, of course, also flow-on effects to other asset markets. Purchases of long-term securities can be undertaken in association with or independently of quantitative easing. In the former case, the central bank would buy long-term bonds and pay for them by adding to banks' reserves. In the latter, it would buy long-term bonds but pay for them by selling some of its existing holdings of short-term securities or even by issuing its own securities, thereby leaving reserve balances unchanged. Purchases of long-term securities can also contain an element of credit easing if the securities purchased carry credit risk. At their most basic, credit easing measures might involve simply expanding the range of collateral that central banks will accept in their repo operations. Most central banks in the world have done this over the past couple of years, and so can be thought of as having engaged in some limited form of credit easing. But the term is normally understood to apply to more forceful measures, such as providing long-term central bank funding to vehicles set up to acquire private securities or loans, outright purchases by central banks of securities carrying credit risk, and guaranteeing some part of the assets held by commercial banks. These measures involve decisions about the allocation of credit between specific institutions and specific sectors of the economy. This is usually a function of fiscal policy, whereas monetary policy normally is general in its application. The measures therefore start to blur the distinction between monetary and fiscal policy. As with normal monetary policy, the impact of these unconventional measures is likely to take quite some time to become apparent. This is particularly the case for measures involving bank reserves. Given the relatively limited time that most of these measures have been in place, it is therefore premature at this stage to draw any firm conclusions about their effectiveness. Also, as most of these measures are undertaken relatively simultaneously, only their combined effects can be judged. So far, their main impact seems to have been on market pricing, which is starting to return to more normal levels. One guide to the effectiveness of these measures may come from past episodes, such as that in Japan in the earlier part of this decade. Of course, circumstances differ greatly from country to country, so there are limits on the extent to which one country's past experiences are relevant to others. The Japanese episode was quite prolonged. The economy started to stagnate following the collapse of property prices and the stock market in the late 1980s. The interaction of macroeconomic weakness and instability in the banking sector exacerbated the downturn. Through the 1990s, the Bank of Japan responded to this by lowering short-term interest rates, but by 1999, the policy rate had been reduced to zero. In 2001, the Bank of Japan switched from targeting an interest rate to an explicit target for banks' reserve balances. The target was initially set at 5 trillion yen and then subsequently raised several times to a peak of about 35 trillion yen. Relative to GDP, this increase in reserves was not dissimilar to the increases recently experienced by some other major central banks. During the quantitative easing period, base money expanded rapidly due to the increase in banks' deposits with the Bank of Japan. While one can never know what the counterfactual would have been in the absence of this policy, the evidence available indicates that the expansion of the money base did little to boost broader monetary aggregates or bank lending. Instead, banks appear to have hoarded the additional liquidity. Bank lending had been contracting since the late 1990s and continued to do so through to about 2006. Research conducted by the Bank of Japan concluded that the ability of quantitative easing to impact on aggregate demand and prices was limited. The Bank of Japan's experience also provides some evidence in relation to yield curve measures. Its quantitative easing was implemented by buying long-term government bonds, and it also gave a commitment to maintain official interest rates at zero for a long time. In effect, therefore, the quantitative easing undertaken by the Bank of Japan was combined with measures to flatten the yield curve. The evidence suggests that these measures were effective in lowering the yield curve in Japan, particularly the medium-term point of the yield curve. Let me conclude then. With central banks doing so many unconventional things, it's not surprising that there is considerable debate about the effectiveness and consequences of the various measures. On the one hand, some argue that the measures will be ineffective. On the other side of the debate, others argue that they will eventually result in higher inflation. Those of the former view point to the experience of Japan over the past decade as supporting their case. The conclusion they draw from that experience is that if the household and corporate sectors are seeking to consolidate their balance sheets and banks remain risk-averse and capital-constrained, simply adding to banks' reserves at the central bank may not result in any generalised expansion of money and credit. The other side of the debate, that the measures will result in inflation, implicitly assumes that the measures will be effective in stimulating the economy. Since money does not miraculously transform into inflation without affecting economic and financial activity. Rather, their argument is that central banks will be too slow to reverse the various measures. As there are no technical factors that would prevent or slow the reversal of these measures, they can be reversed simultaneously or in any sequence, the argument must rest on central banks making incorrect policy judgments. This is always a possibility, but the high state of awareness that currently exists about the risk of being too slow to reverse recent exceptional measures should limit the probability of such a mistake being made. Thank you.
Rick, Glenn Rosal from BBY. Just regarding the Japanese example, surely demographics and energy import requirements would have affected the outcome regarding Japan in terms of its lack of recovery. That's one thing, and I'd like you to comment on that. The other issue I just wanted you to comment on was the possible indirect on taxation rates, particularly marginal tax rates. And I know you have fiscal tied up in that as well, but if you look at the US experience after the Great Depression, marginal tax rates got up to 90% at one stage. So I'm just wondering whether there's been any examination of that as part of the examination of the quantitative easing process as well. Thank you.
Well, certainly, you're right. Japan is not the United States or Europe or the UK. The economic situation in Japan differed at that time from the current experience in other countries in several important respects, particularly in relation to these structural sort of factors that you mentioned. So that's why I said that you don't have to be careful in using the experience of one country to apply it to other countries. Nonetheless, I think the lack of flow-through from money-based to broader aggregates was so clear that I think even looking through that, it does raise concerns in some people's minds about the effectiveness of those measures. Now, in relation to marginal tax rates, I don't think I've got any particular comments to make in that regard, I'm afraid.
Rick Rob Thomas from SDIA, and I'm not an economist, so these might be a bit basic, but the crowding out effect of all these deficits around the world on interest rates as distinct from the stimulation of economic activity on inflation. Do you have any view? And secondly, any view as to the accounting changes that have occurred, such as IFRS, and whether or not you would roll back some of those if you had the chance?
Well, on the accounting changes, I'm really no expert on accounting, so I'll stay out of that if you don't mind. On the fiscal policy side, I really think this is going to be a major challenge for the world economy over the next 5 to 10 years, because the world's facing a very substantial rise in the amount of government debt relative to world output, something like a third of annual GDP. This is a very major increase, and it'll be interesting to see how that is accommodated without causing some very major changes in relative prices in asset markets. As you know already, in the last few weeks, bond yields in many parts of the world have risen quite noticeably. I think mainly that is a reflection of the fact that, well, firstly, there is a bit more confidence in the future of the world economy, but I think it's also weighing on investors' minds that there's a lot of bond supply coming up. So I think this is going to be a big issue for the world.
Thanks, Rick. In the days that I did Economics One, there was a lot of discussion about moral suasion between the Reserve Bank and where it saw particular areas that might be overinflated, be there city units at some point or MIS schemes or whatever it might be, they actually took some action. We seem to, across the whole regulatory framework, be it you or ASIC or the ASX for that matter, have moved back from interaction and moral suasion. And particularly in the case of the Reserve Bank, all we hear about is interest rates. It's interesting you're talking about quantitative easing. But how much work is going on in the moral suasion area these days?
Well, it's interesting you say that because, once we move to deregulated markets, the power of the authorities over individual institutions is very much diminished. But nonetheless, avenue is still there, and I think the bank did use that, particularly through, the second half of the 90s in relation to the housing market. We had a period there when house prices were rising quite quickly. We were addressing that mainly through higher interest rates. But at the same time, the bank made various statements, put out research, pointing to the dangers that would come if house prices kept rising. APRA talked to the banks, asked them to do stress tests. All these things at the margin would have helped contain the increase in house prices that was going on then. So those instruments are probably less effective than they were 20 years ago. I think that's just the natural order of things. But we still use them to the best of our ability. And I think there have been an important difference between what's happened here in Australia and what's happening in some other countries.
Stephen Long from the ABC. Mr. Battaglino, you mentioned house prices, but for years I've been listening to you say household finances in Australia are in great shape and there's no problem with the record levels of household debt. Yet the last two cash rate rises by the Reserve Bank crunched the economy to a standstill even before the global financial crisis hit here big time, and now personal lending's gone backwards, adding to the recessionary momentum. Do you think you might have got it wrong?
Well, you won't be surprised to hear me say no. I don't think the facts support your case. As late as September last year, demand in Australia was still growing, real demand was still growing by 4%. That is faster than average. So well into that crisis period, we still had much faster than average growth in demand. People underestimate the amount of pressure that was faced by the Australian economy in the last couple of years. The resources boom we had here was the biggest boom we've had for 50 years. The last time we had a boom of this magnitude, inflation rose to 20%. All sorts of things went wrong in the economy. This time, we've got through that boom relatively unscathed. But the idea that we're going to come through that with no rises in interest rates is just ridiculous. Well, and
how come GDP growth fell even to basically zero, just ahead of zero, even before we saw that big round of crisis on world markets and the Reserve Bank started cutting rates?
The main thing the bank's monetary policy works on is not GDP, it works on demand. It's demand that causes the inflationary pressure. The GDP is affected by a whole range of other things, including the competitiveness of businesses in Australia. There's all sorts of things affecting that, which are beyond the control of the Reserve Bank. The world economy made a major structural change after the collapse of Lehman Brothers. You can see it in every piece of data. Confidence collapsed simultaneously around the world. That was just such a dramatic event. Up until then, forecasters such as the IMF were still forecasting that next year's growth in world output was going to be around average levels. Nothing much had changed. It all changed after the Lehman's collapsed.
You mentioned that clearly a lot of forecasters got it wrong, but the Reserve Bank got it pretty badly wrong, in a sense, didn't they, by failing to warn about the build-up of risk in financial markets, the US housing crisis, the possible knock-on effects, and underestimating the impact. Now, you were heading the financial markets section of the Reserve Bank for a long time. I'm wondering what led the Reserve Bank not to really pick that up to the extent that it might have.
Well, again, I don't think that is supported by the facts. Our main responsibility here is for Australian financial markets. And I have to say, I think we were pretty active in setting out the risks in Australian markets. In relation to the overseas markets, there are umpteen reports by central banks, IMF, BIS, pointing to the risks that were going on in financial markets. You couldn't pick up a publication that had been produced in the last 5 years that didn't spell out those risks. It was everywhere. So you can't say that central banks weren't onto that one.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.